All right, good afternoon, counsel. So in preparation for this case, Justice Perigary discovered that he has a conflict in this matter, so he'll be recusing. Another justice will be appointed to sit in his stead, review the arguments, and participate in the deliberations. So Justice Silver and I are ready to proceed. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
I am, thank you.
Okay, would you like to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, 4 minutes, please.
All right, please proceed. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Jamie Resch on behalf of the appellant, David Burns. I would love to start with the actual issues in the case, but before we do that, I suppose we better take a moment, talk about this so-called appeal waiver and why it is no impediment to hearing the merits of the claims here today. Now, bear in mind, of course, what the waiver waives, if anything, is claims that arose during the so-called guilt phase of the trial. Now, here's two ways that you know that the waiver issue is no issue at all, and they're both found in the answering brief. Number one, the answering brief never even tries to define what is meant by guilt phase. All we have, really, is trial counsel's thoughts from the post-conviction proceeding, which were that it meant the state's case in chief. Does it mean something else? The state never attempts to explain what it would be if it does. And number two, in fact, I would go so far as to say the answering brief repeatedly attempts to pass off to this court, like it did during the post-conviction proceeding, that Mr. Burns waived all of his appellate claims. An example is on page 17 of the answering brief. At the risk of repeating our reply, I would just say this once, that if the state wanted to say that Mr. Burns waived all of his claims, it presumably could have done so, and that is not what the agreement says at all. It's our position under longstanding, virtually unquestionable rules, which I believe both parties agree on, that plea agreements are construed against the state. And for us, that's the end of this issue. That the only thing that Mr. Burns waived, if anything, was claims that arose during the state's presentation of evidence. And I feel that we've honored that because we're not presenting any of those types of claims here in this appeal. One issue that we do present, and again, this arises before the jury was even seated, is the Batson issue. So with that, that's where I would hope to spend most of my time. With respect to it, the prosecution provided some 9 or 10 reasons for the strike of the juror number 91, the very first juror that was questioned in the case. I'd like to discuss three of them here briefly, and these are all found on page 1207 and 1208 in the record. Number one, the prosecutor, in providing the reason, specifically said that one of them was whether the juror was asked whether he could impose the death penalty and so-called said, "I can do my best." Bear in mind, there was no challenge for cause in the case, and it's been our position that the juror not only did not say that, but in fact repeatedly said that he could impose the death penalty. To be sure, the juror was not a big believer in the death penalty, but you're not required to like it as long as you can impose it. So we challenged in the brief that the juror even said, "I could do my best." And one would think in the answering brief there maybe would have been a line and page type response where the juror had said that if he did. Yet again, the answering brief was silent on that topic, which I would suggest confirms that the juror said no such thing. A second justification for the strike was along the lines of that the juror had said you should be able to coach a kid in the opportunity for rehabilitation, and that that applied even if it's proven he's the one who did it. Again, we would suggest the juror said no such thing. If we refer to page 128 of the record, there is a long-winded response from the juror that does end with the words, "coach a kid." But the point the juror seemed to be making was one about recidivism and nothing else about the case. He certainly never said that he would refuse to consider the death penalty for someone who committed a gruesome crime, regardless of whether they had actually committed it or not, or as opposed to participated in it indirectly. A final justification builds on this and was given by the prosecutor as being that the juror had said, "For children, I believe in rehabilitation." And I would again direct the court to page 128 in the record where the juror gives his responses. And again, he simply said no such thing. Certainly never that he would decline to impose a death sentence based on the Mr. Burns' age at the time of the offense. So if we take all those in context, moving on to the judge's reasons for denying the Batson challenge, these are on page 1208 in the record. A problem, and it doesn't make anybody's job here any easier, is that the judge does not discuss anything the prosecutor said, and instead sort of went his own direction and said, well, I've reviewed the questionnaire, and the juror doesn't believe in the death penalty, so therefore the strike was valid, was essentially the judge's reasoning.
Mr. Resch?
But again...
Mr. Resch, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. What is your position on the scope of this waiver? So is it your position that jury selection is not part of the guilt phase? What do you think is preserved for argument by the defendant after this waiver?
Again, I would go back to trial counsel's understanding of it was the guilt phase is the case is the state's case in chief, the time when evidence of guilt is presented to the jury. So it would be our position that that is certainly after the jury is seated and opening statements have been given. Maybe we can include opening statements in it. There are no challenges to those presented in this appeal. It certainly didn't include closing statements, so I don't think it would be possible to say it was as broad as everything prior to the verdict. And in fact, again, that would the only way you could get to that type of view would be to say, well, let's read it in favor of the state to give it as broad a reading as possible. But again, the authorities don't suggest you to do that. In fact, they say to do the opposite, give it, you know, construe it in Mr. Burns' favor and against the state. So our position is certainly the Batson claim would not be precluded by it, nor would anything, I guess at best I would say between maybe the opening statement and the closing statement would be the, or not even the closing statement, I'm sorry, the close of the case, the state's case in chief, because closing arguments were specifically something that trial counsel said would be exempted from the agreement. Is that... answer that as best as I can, or okay. All right. So, again, with the judge's reasoning, okay. I think there's two problems with it. One is there's a high reliance, in fact, exclusive reliance on answers in the questionnaire. But if we read the prosecution's so-called reasons for the strike closely, not only did they not mention answers in the questionnaire as any basis for the strike, but in fact specifically said that the basis of the strike was the answers given in response to questions presented during jury selection both by the state and the defense. So there's almost an exclusion of the questionnaire responses by the state as a basis for the strike. Second, and again, this is on, if we look at page 126 on the record, it's a little jumbled, but it's clear that the juror has given conflicting responses in the questionnaire, and that's the bulk of the state's questioning. So to say that the juror definitively said something in the questionnaire is not accurate in the first instance, and second, was the whole point of the questioning of the juror, which led to the state's explanation for the strike. So if we move on to what this court should look for, okay, here's a fun fact. In the last year, there's been at least six Batson cases presented to this court, two of which have resulted in reversals. One of those was published, the Matthews case, which we discussed extensively in the opening brief. And again, there was no response to any of that discussion in the answering brief. Some takeaways that I would suggest for this court, which I found in Matthews. Again, number one, there was a preference towards trial courts making a clear record of determination of strikes and reasoning for granting or denying them. And regrettably, again, we didn't really get that here because the trial judge didn't talk about the prosecutor's reasons for the strike whatsoever. A second takeaway from Matthews is when strikes aren't supported by the record, that is evidence in itself of purposeful discrimination. And here, I would suggest we have identified three statements by the prosecutor to justify the strike that do not appear in the record, which were, again, that the juror would do his best to impose the death penalty. Number two, that the comment about coaching a kid, even if he did it, and number three, that for children, the juror believed in rehabilitation. I guess along those lines, I would also mention, if we compare, and I hate to keep hounding on the answering brief, okay, but it's fair to say that words matter, and if the state had a response to some of this stuff, one would expect it to be in there. If you compare page 27 of the answering brief to page 1207 in the record, again, the answering brief focuses on the questionnaire responses as a basis for the strike, but that is not what the prosecutor said at all at the time that the explanation was put on the record during the trial. So again, I would suggest this shift in logic for the basis of the strike is itself evidence that the strike was improper. We do apologize. I can't see the clock.
You have 5 minutes and 45 seconds.
Okay, I've got it now. I apologize. Thank you. All right, real briefly then, let me talk about the comparative findings before I pass my time. I would suggest, just based on the lack of support in the record and the judge's decision, which doesn't even discuss the prosecutor's reasons, we're already pretty far along to saying there's a viable Batson claim here. But to add on with the comparative analysis, this addresses a couple of other explanations given by the prosecutor, which included that the juror had said death was too easy and that the juror believed in rehabilitation. The opening brief discussed the very next juror that was questioned, number 93, specifically agreed that life in prison could be worse than a death sentence, and also went on to say that helping children should be a goal of the criminal justice system, yet juror number 93 was seated and juror number 91 was struck.
Mr. Resch, I really have some questions about the scope of this waiver, these prospective waivers.
Okay, sure.
How do we determine, when you say guilt phase, you've just said, oh, it's from opening to closing. Why isn't jury selection part of the guilt phase? Why isn't that, when you're in trial, I think when you're selecting a jury, you probably tell people, I'm in trial. Why isn't that part of this? So why isn't that, why aren't those claims waived? And then is it possible for the defendant to waive claims they don't know about yet? So the prospective waiver would seem to suggest anything that happened before, he's waived, and anything that happens after the waiver, that becomes a question. Clearly reserve the closing arguments. But other than that, there could have been any number of things that occurred after that waiver. Are those covered? So I want to kind of redirect you just to that. To me, this is one of the big, and my colleague may feel differently, but this is one of the big issues in the case for me.
Okay, certainly. I can appreciate that. And again, I would go back to the time during the trial when evidence of guilt, the guilt phase, is presented is exclusively the state's case in chief. And again, I'm not alone in thinking that. That's the way trial counsel explained that they understood it during the post-conviction proceeding. Again, if the jury is not even seated, I can understand what you might tell a colleague, hey, I'm in trial, we're waiting for the jury, etc. But I don't know that guilt phase is so readily understood that it has some sort of common usage that would apply in all cases. If there was an ambiguous nature of it, then again, either the state could have clarified that in making the agreement or at least put it on the record. None of that occurred. Or if it isn't clear, then Mr. Burns should get the benefit of the doubt on the issue. And so to the extent, I guess I'll take your question as we're trying to find a definition that is commonly understood for guilt phase. I don't know that that necessarily exists other than what I'm trying to pass it off as, which is the state's case in chief. If it's something different than that, then I would suggest the state should have said so in the plea agreement or waiver agreement, however we want to define it, and they didn't. As far as prospective claims, again, focusing on the issues that we raised in the appeal, there really are only a couple that would have arisen after. And again, I don't know how you could necessarily waive a constitutional issue that had not occurred yet, especially given the terse nature of the agreement in this case. And those were the Jabs video that was never admitted into evidence, but yet given to the jury to consider, and then, of course, the sentencing issue. I think it would be virtually unquestionable the sentencing issue is not encompassed by the agreement, but neither should be the Jabs issue as it arose. Again, after the case was given to the jury, I realize that it's before the verdict, but again, if the state wanted to define guilt phase as everything prior to the verdict.
Mr. Resch, isn't the Jabs issue waived? The district court got consent from Burns and the state over the phone before that went into the deliberation room. Isn't that correct?
I certainly agree that's how the record reads. I don't know that that necessarily means it's waived. I certainly approached it in the brief as a plain error type issue, given the nature of the proceedings below. So I could agree with that much. I don't know that the court is foreclosed from considering a constitutional issue just because counsel didn't object to it.
Well, what's the constitutional issue there?
Well, we had phrased it as both the undue emphasis that was placed on the video as well as a violation of the confrontation right to the extent that the video is the state's key witness and it's based on something that wasn't even really evidence. I mean, I get the point about the Jabs video and the time that probably the court was trying to save. But that really wasn't a best practice at a minimum and arguably was a constitutional violation to the extent that Mr. Burns had a right to be present.
And
when
Mr. Burns,
key witnesses giving evidence.
And Mr.
Him.
Burns agreed to that procedure, correct? Mr. Burns could have said, nope, bring him into the courtroom and play this out here, right?
He certainly could have done that. On the other hand, I would just suggest he is, of course, dealing with some severe disabilities and certainly at the mercy of what his counsel wants to do in the case. We're down to 30 seconds here, so I would reserve the rest of this time, if I may, please.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Resch. Ms. Weckerle?
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Pam Weckerle, and I was one of the trial lawyers in the case for the Clark County District Attorney's Office. On August 7th of 2010, appellant David Burns, Monica Martinez, Willie Mason, and Stephanie Cousins were discussing committing a robbery. Ms. Cousins knew a sort of a soft target where she had purchased drugs before and knew that if they robbed that location, there was unlikely to be armed resistance. That was the home of the eventual murder victim in this case, Doresia Newman, her partner, Cornelius Mayo, several children, including 12-year-old Devania. Ms. Cousins set up the transaction. Monica Martinez was the driver. When Doresia opened the door, Burns and Mason pushed in. Mr. Burns was the one who had the gun. He shot Doresia in the head and chased 12-year-old Devania down the hall, eventually shooting her, although she did survive her injuries. Throughout pretrial litigation, the state reached negotiations with Ms. Martinez and Ms. Cousins, and ultimately we went to trial in a joint trial against Mr. Burns and Willie Mason. Burns's case was capital. Near the end of the trial, there was an agreement reached with Mr. Burns and his lawyers. And the agreement, as Justice Stiglitz has alluded to, was if he was convicted of first-degree murder, the state would not proceed to a penalty hearing, essentially seeking death. Instead, he and the state would agree on a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. What the state got out of the bargain was that he would waive his appellate rights. And yet, here we are. Appellant's brief suggests, Mr. Resch just argued to this court that somehow this waiver was limited to literally the, I guess, opening argument to maybe the close of evidence. I don't understand how that would even be the case. There was nothing carved out in the agreement. But even assuming that were true, as Justice Stiglitz, you've alluded to, that would eliminate the claim with regard to Batson and also the identification that Devania made in the photographic lineup. Moreover, the plain language of the stipulation and order was waive all appellate rights stemming from the guilt phase of trial. Mr. Burns was canvassed extensively on it, both in terms of the punishment that he would receive, that it was going to be a life without the possibility of parole, and also the waiver of the rights, of his appellate rights. Mr. Scrow, in the sort of colloquy about the waiver, did mention that, the state would be precluded from making improper arguments in closing arguments, and he sort of alluded to the fact that sometimes that's fertile ground for appeal. But then he indicated because co-defendant Mason had retained his appellate rights, there was sort of a built-in safety mechanism to ensure that there were no improper arguments made by the state. And indeed, Mr. Mason's case has already gone up on appeal, and this court, he did raise some issues of improper argument, albeit not identical, but there were suggestions that some of the arguments made by the state were improper, but this court found otherwise and affirmed his conviction. In the appeal on this case with regard to his habeas proceeding, this court again recognized that there was a waiver. The court said during trial, Burns waived all appellate claims arising from the guilt phase of his trial pursuant to a stipulation with the state to a sentence of life without the possibility of parole if he were to be convicted in exchange for the state withdrawing its notice of intent to seek the death penalty. Now, Mr. Burns never proceeded to a penalty phase, and he was convicted of first-degree murder. He was sentenced as agreed to life without the possibility of parole with regard to the murder count. and the state is here before this court arguing an appeal. The state's position is respectfully that this is not, we did not get the benefit of our bargain, that he waived these very rights that he's complaining of before this court. If the court has no additional question, oh, sorry.
Yeah, I do have, unless there's a particular area you want to go, but I want to, how should this court, in advancing jurisprudence is its own reward, so you'll get the benefit of that bargain here, because this is interesting. How do we deal with prospective waivers? Because maybe it's not the case here, but you have a prospective waiver, and obviously looking back is easy. I waive what's happened before.
Right.
But now we don't know what's going to happen. So maybe not in this case. Does that mean if there's some egregious constitutional violation and numerous errors, that we wouldn't be able to address those? Would they have to be anticipated like some federal courts have held? Tell me your thoughts on that.
So I believe that obviously, looking back on this now, we could have worded the stipulation a little more with more detail and more broadly. However, to your question, I would say that they have to reserve those rights in order to retain them as appellate rights. As I think you're alluding to, this case is a little bit unique situationally because we had the co-defendant. So in some sense, if argument just went crazy, there was going to be sort of a built-in mechanism of safety. And then in addition, I would say that Mr. Burns never waived any of his post-conviction rights, and those could have been raised as well as addressing whether or not in post-conviction it was proper for or ineffective for defense counsel to enter into this agreement. But if you want me to talk to the argument part or the other issues that were raised on appeal, in this particular case, it's the state's position, one, that it's waived, but two, certainly there was no error. And just to sort of emphasize that a little more, at a minimum, I would say even the most restrictive interpretation of this agreement would be sort of backward looking. We are waiving up to this point. I don't think there can be any question about the intent of the parties at that point, because obviously the defense could have raised, hey, we want to hold on to this one issue that came up pre-trial or during jury selection. And that was absolutely not discussed. It's not part of the plain language, and it certainly wasn't part of the discussion between counsel, the court, or Mr. Burns at the time the stipulation was entered into.
Okay, thank you.
So if at an abundance of caution, with the court's permission, I will move on to the Batson issue. As this court's aware, this all centers around juror 091, and somewhat uniquely, this was the only challenge to all of the strikes made by the state with regard to raising a Batson issue. On the first day of jury selection, this juror indicated that he was from India. This is in volume 1, page 0107. And he indicated, I'm black or halfway there. This is also in volume 1 at page 0138. And what he was alluding to sort of metaphorically is that he had been in Europe and he had been treated poorly, he believed, because of the color of his skin. So I think he was sort of making a metaphorical description of how he had experienced discrimination. In fact, the only African-American prospective juror who was struck from the group of 28 was struck by defense counsel. This is at volume 6, page 1212. Four African-Americans were on the panel before that strike, and three actually ended up serving on our jury. This is at volume 6, page 1212 as well. And so the state is sort of left with this question. We kick a single juror who indicated on his questionnaire that he didn't believe in the death penalty. And from the state's perspective, there's a lot of arguments to be made, but the most obvious one within the framework of Batson is that that's sufficient for a prima facie case, that is sufficient to show a pattern. Respectfully, the state disagrees with that. This juror's questionnaire indicated he would be quite reluctant to be someone who would consider capital punishment, in particular for someone who was young. And in this case, we had an 18-year-old defendant whose co-defendants were all substantially older than him. On appeal, there was, or in argument, there was a comparison made between this juror and the next juror who was questioned. This is juror 093. I respectfully disagree that those jurors were similarly situated. The questionnaire on juror 093, the one who ended up making it on the panel.
What's your response to how the district court handled that strike?
So, Justice Silver, I think initially...
I guess what I'm asking is, he brought up Matthews as well.
Yes.
So we have the same, you know, how would you respond to that with Matthews being just recently decided?
I think that, I mean, it isn't like the most clear record, but I think there is a clear finding made by Judge Thompson that they did not meet their burden of establishing a prima facie case. And then he kind of, and then that finding is actually explicitly made on the record, but then the state goes ahead and says, we'll give you our race neutral reason, you know, in addition to that, and those reasons
were... But the district court has to tie up that nexus, not the state. That's exactly like Matthews.
Well, I think he did make his own determination. Admittedly, all these records can always, I mean, be a little more clear. But even if the court were to say, okay, the record wasn't clearly made with regard to prong one, certainly the state offered race-neutral reasons that indicated that this juror would be less inclined to impose the death penalty, particularly on our defendant. There was the suggestion that if you compared this juror with juror 093, that you would somehow see a pattern of disparate treatment. The questionnaires on these two jurors were different. 093 said she believed in the death penalty. This is at volume 1, page 160. 091, the juror who was struck, said he did not believe in the death penalty but was willing to consider it. Volume 1 at page 124 to 125. Where these two jurors overlapped was they both said that they believed that life without the possibility of parole would be a worse punishment than the death penalty. But the follow-up questioning with regard to these two jurors was critically different. With regard to juror 91, the one who we struck, we asked that juror that when you have that belief, that's assuming that the person sitting in custody has a conscience and is examining their conduct and is sort of suffering through the reality of what they did. And that juror indicated that he believed that everyone had a conscience and everyone could reach that level of consciousness where they're sort of examining their conduct. By contrast, when that same type of question was advanced to juror 093, the suggestion was made that maybe life without wouldn't be so bad for someone who didn't have a conscience and wasn't, you know, examining their soul over what they had done. And juror 93 said, yeah, that's true, or essentially acknowledged that maybe that wouldn't be the case if the person didn't have that same sort of level of regret and consideration of their actions. In addition, juror 091, the one who we struck, indicated a reluctance to impose punishment on youthful offenders. For all of these reasons, certainly it's the state's position that there is no pattern established, and if the court were somehow to examine the record, there is zero indication that this strike was based on reasons of race, and that it was all tied to whether or not this juror would be a good juror on penalty. As at the time we were doing jury selection, the issue was obviously whether or not someone could impose the death penalty. And again, I would remind this panel, whoever these justices, that there were many There were other African-American jurors who sat on this panel who ended up being part of our jury. So there's, you know, we've got one person, and it's respectfully that is just not a pattern. I'm down to like 15 seconds, but I would just sum up to say that from the state's perspective, you know, we enter into these agreements and we should be entitled to the benefit of our bargain, and respectfully, we don't believe that we should be here.
All right, thank you, Ms. Weckerly. Mr. Resch?
Thank you.
I'm going to jump right in and just follow up after Ms. Weckerly's last statement and ask you, didn't the defendant in this case get what he bargained for at the end of the day? He got exactly the life without. So how is he prejudiced by this plea agreement in the middle of trial?
Well, Your Honor, he...
On direct appeal, I'm saying.
I mean, that is the sentence that he got. But again, our position is the bargain was that all guilt phase, whatever that means, claims were waived on appeal. It didn't mean all claims, you know, and I would go so far as say that I agree with Ms. Weckerly that this is a somewhat unique case. We probably won't see this type of agreement with this type of language again, which makes it not a particularly attractive case to make a grand holding about what may or may not happen in future cases. I would just ask the court to deal with the issue before it. You have a terse, poorly worded agreement, which we think left open certain claims to raise on appeal, to include those that occurred before the state's case in chief or after the agreement was made, and just deal with the issues that we have before us. Post-conviction was not a particularly helpful place for the Batson claim to be raised because there was an objection below. I really don't have a criticism other than that it wasn't granted by the trial court, which would be appropriate for direct appeal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Resch. This court will stand.
Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments. This court will stand in recess until 2:00.